Welcome to another episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast with your hosts, Sean Sorrentino and Aaron Paulette.
Welcome to episode 135 of the Gunblog Variety Cast, a proud member of the Self-Defense Radio Network. How are you doing, Aaron?
Well, my birthday was last Saturday, and so I want to thank everyone who wished me well and sent me cards and presents. Thank you all very, very much. Now, I don't want to say how old I am. I've still got a little bit of vanity. In fact, I like to say that I'm old enough to know better, but still young enough to be vain about it. But I will say that I'm a Magnum caliber now. I had a very nice birthday, and I would like to think that I am aging like a fine scotch.
So we should just put you back in the bottle.
Oh, honey, nobody puts Aaron back in the bottle. Mm-mm. So the other big news I have is that a friend of mine named William Hilton has commissioned a print run of Operation Blazing Sword patches. Now, I've only seen the prototype, and I've only seen the picture of it, not in real life, but what I've seen looks really great. Now, these patches are 4 inches high, and they're on printed canvas, and they cost $9 with shipping, and any overage on that is going to go to benefit Operation Blazing Sword. Now, there's a link in the show notes to my blog, which has a picture of the patch, as well as the email address for ordering it, so you don't have to scramble and write it down now. Now, the deadline for placing your order is April 3rd, which is 2 weeks from when you listen to this, if you're listening to it in a timely manner. So, order yours today.
Well, Aaron, does it have Velcro backing?
No. It does not. However, what you can do is buy Velcro backing separately and iron that sucker on.
But what if I wanted it to have Velcro backing? Can't I just buy one with Velcro backing? Is there a good reason why they wouldn't just sell them with Velcro backing to begin with?
Well, there's actually a very good logistical reason for that. Apparently, there are several different types of Velcro, and putting it on is such a nightmare for the company that they decided, just categorically, they were never, ever going to put Velcro on their patches at all, period, end of conversation.
And I read William's comment on that, and I thought, you know what? That actually makes a lot of sense. So if you want Velcro, go down to the craft store and buy some Velcro.
Yeah. So how are you doing, Sean? I understand you had another shooting match.
I was going to say, it was a match, Aaron. I've not been involved in another shooting. I haven't been involved in a first shooting, to be honest.
I was trying to sound all professional and not do shooting match doohickey thing.
Actually, I did pretty well. Came in 26th out of 50 in my division, which is stock service pistol with a bone stock gun. Stock service pistol is basically don't make any external modifications to the gun that aren't purely decorative. Like, I could paint it if I wanted, but I couldn't change the trigger in a way they could see from the outside. I think you're allowed to change the sights on the gun. It's clearly the most popular category since 50 out of the 84 people that were shooting in stock service pistol. So I did 26th out of 50. I was 34th out of 84 overall, which is not too bad, actually.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
What I thought was interesting was that I wore my IDPA fishing vest for the very first time, and everybody treated me like I knew what I was doing. I'm wearing the uniform, so obviously this guy, he knows what he's doing, so we'll pay attention to him. We'll ask him questions. I was like, this is my second time here, guys. So I ended up being the scorer for the squad. If you've ever been to a match, there's the range officer or the safety officer, depending on what they call it, and he holds the timer and he gives the commands and all that other happy stuff. And then when the shooting is over, he clears the weapon. He tells the person to unload and show clear and slide down hammer holster. Calls the range clear, and then he walks around scoring the targets. Down 0, down 1, down 5, whatever it happens to be. Well, the scorer is the person with the clipboard, or if you have a computerized version with the Kindle, or I think it's a Nook actually, follows him around and writes those numbers down. So I ended up doing that. It's a job I actually like. I'm either going to sit there like a lump, having to get up and sit down and get up and sit down to pace targets, or I could just follow the guy around with a clipboard and write stuff down, which I'm actually pretty good at, having learned to write all the way back in grade school. I have a lot of practice.
Yeah.
I'm in fact better at writing things down than I am at shooting targets. So, I mean, it was just right up my alley. There were two of us being scorers. But what happened was, is I'd shoot very early in the stage, right? So I'd shoot, like, I was number four. I would shoot, then I would reload my magazines, and then I would get up and I'd take the clipboard away from the guy about four people before he had to shoot. And then he'd get ready, practice, you know, do his little mental walkthrough, that sort of stuff. And then he would shoot, and then he'd go reload his magazines. And by that point, we were done with everybody on the squad. We had, I think it was 12 people, and the RO, he shot this, you know, in two different categories. So he'd shoot twice. So I'd score for like six, and the other guy'd score for like six. And basically, this range officer, and he was like, go, 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 go. I mean, like, everything was done so quickly. I never had time to take a break or anything. I'm like, the time we had to go to the bathroom, we're all like, what are we going to do? Are we going to have time to run all the way across the rifle range and, you know, hit the toilet? The RO, his name was Brandon. He was really, really good. And I am going to try to be on his squad from now on, because when people are organized and they get things done, they're so much easier to deal with than that sort of, you know, half-ass, I wonder what's next. It was night and day difference between that and some other times I've been out shooting. And so, yeah, definitely shout out to Brandon. I'm not sure he will ever hear this, but good job. The one thing, though, that really bothered me about this match was there were people who were sitting on their fat behinds and not getting up and pasting targets. You've never been to a match.
No, I haven't.
If you shoot the target, you leave a hole in it, and you obviously can't leave extra holes in the target for the next guy, so they have these little pasters, and, you know, they're about, I don't know, half an inch square, maybe? They're mm-hmm. the same color as the target, and you go up and you stick the little sticky on top of the hole.
Right.
That way you have a clean target, right?
Yeah.
Well, this has to happen for every single target, every single run. And if you've got 6-8 targets and some steel that they may have knocked down, well, this all has to be pasted. And if your butt is sitting down, not doing anything, well, that means everybody else has to get the work done. So if you're going to go to a match, get off your fat, lazy butt and go and paste targets. Please. It's really freaking annoying.
Young man, did you just assume their weight?
No, I am speaking specifically of two people, and they were fat and lazy.
Well, okay then.
Yeah. The lazy I inferred from their lack of activity. The fat I could see. This coming from the guy who weighs 220 pounds. Fat. There was one funny thing that happened. On stage five, there was a place where you could stand and you could see both the second group of targets you were going to shoot and the third group of targets. And in IDPA, you have to stand behind cover. Okay. It just so happened that the cover lines, if you want to call them that, sort of converged at one spot. Well, the stage wasn't briefed that way. The stage was briefed that you would start at position one. There was three targets in front of you that were like 3 feet away from you or 3 yards or something. It was really close. And you had to fire two rounds at each target while backing away. That was the fastest I've ever shot three targets in my life. It was like bang, 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 bang. I mean, I sounded like, in my own ears, I sounded like Jerry Michalak. He would have probably laughed at me for that speed, but whatever. I go to the second group of targets at P2, position two, and I shoot all them. Then I turned from that position, leaned just a little bit, and shot at the other two targets at position three. I finish, and Brandon, the RO, he looks at me, he's like, well, I don't know how we're going to score that one, because that's not how it was briefed. You're supposed to go up to here. And I said, I'm behind cover. Well, you know, but position three is over there. I said, there's no rule that says I have to crowd my cover, right? What do they teach you? Didn't they teach you that in any gun school you've ever been to? Didn't Moss talk about stuff like that, about how not to climb right up into your cover where you're restricted in your movement?
I think he did a little bit, now that you mention it, but there wasn't a big, huge deal made about it. You know, it wasn't, you know, thou shalt not crowd your cover. It was just sort of a, if you get up too close to it, you may not be able to see everything. So keep that in mind.
Not only can you not see things, what happens is that you can't move your weapon around. What if you have to shoot on the other side of something? Well, now you have to bring the gun into your body and move it over there and then put it back out. When if you just stood back 2 feet, you'd have room to extend your arms. The other thing is when you get up close to the cover gets in the way of where your hands need to be, right? So you're trying to reach around the cover in some weird way while your arms are wider than the gun is. The bullet literally needs 9 millimeters of free air to travel down. Well, your arms are bigger than that. So it's really awkward. So stand off your cover. Well, I stood off the cover for maybe, I don't know, 3 yards and could shoot my target just fine. I figure, you know what? If 9 feet is going to make the difference between me hitting and me missing, I probably was going to miss in the beginning. So, I mean, what the heck? I'll just stand here and shoot it. Well, I hit the target. Didn't have any trouble. Well, once I said the rules don't say I have to crowd my cover, he's like, well, okay, good. So I got it. I've got links to the match video and scores in the show notes. Check out the match video. It is pretty funny. You can see a lot of the mistakes I make, which is why I take the video, so I can see those mistakes and maybe start working on correcting them. So I've also started wearing a new piece of gear, the SFD Responder from Safer Faster Defense. It's basically an ankle holster for medical gear. TAM has been basically on everybody. Hey, you need to carry a tourniquet. Hey, if you're carrying a second magazine for your gun, but you're not carrying a tourniquet, you probably have your priorities backwards. And I'm like, where am I going to put a tourniquet, right? I'm not putting it in my pocket. It'd be one more thing for me to forget in my pants and wash, piss my wife off. I don't want yet one more thing on my belt. I already feel like I'm wearing a bat belt with just the two magazines and the gun. And I've got a flashlight in my pocket. If I didn't have a second magazine, I'd try to figure out how to put the flashlight on my belt next to the magazine. I mean, do I really want to hang another thing off my belt? Well, a couple weeks ago, I don't know which episode it was, Mike Seeklander was talking about this SFD responder ankle carry thingy for all kinds of medical gear. And he's listing off all the stuff he's carrying. I'm like, sounds like a lot of stuff. But it also sounded like the contents of the bag that I got from ambulance driver at the shooter self-care class at NRA annual meeting in Nashville, right? It's got a tourniquet, it's got chest seals, it's got, I'm like, hey, you know what? This might work. So I've spent some time trying to find it. It's kind of pricey. It's about $50, $60, depending on which color you get for the SFD responder itself. And then you got to fill the thing up. So there's all the medical gear that goes into it. I think I spent probably $150 total on the kit and the way to carry it. In it, I've got a tourniquet, I've got chest seals, I've got hemostatic gauze, I got a mini pressure dressing, I got a little rescue hook knife, a ballpoint pen, some medical gloves, and you know that Streamlight Stylus Pro flashlight that I reviewed, I don't know, 6-8 weeks back? I've got that in there too, so I've always got my flashlight with me, and I don't leave that in my pocket and piss my wife off. I've been wearing it since Saturday, and that includes, you know, the 4 miles a day, basically, that I walk with the dog, 3 miles in the morning and a mile at night. So far, so good. I'm going to give you a better review of it after I've worn it for about a month.
Yeah, I look forward to that. My main, it's not even really an objection. It's just something I noticed because I live in Florida where it's hot all the time. And that sort of thing is great if you're wearing long pants. But if you're wearing shorts, you can't wear that. Well, you can. You'd look like a dork. You know, it would be like wearing socks with your sandals.
Or like wearing a fanny pack.
Yeah. And so it's like, yeah, that's pretty cool. That won't work for me for most of the year, unfortunately. Because I have the same thing. I want to be able to carry the gear, but fitting it on without getting into, you know, full-on double bandolier mode is a problem
yes.
for me.
I do not want to look like an extra from the Predator movie. Like, see, that's okay if you're in the military and you're in the field and carrying field gear. But I've got to look like a normal, respectable human being, especially on the job. I'm out doing my job. I'm in the car. I think it was almost 40,000 miles I drove in the last 12 months. My car, I've had it since October of 2015, and I've got almost 65,000 miles on this car. I'm on the road all the time. And the one time I saw an accident, I was out of the vehicle and I was not carrying my medical gear at the time. It was underneath the passenger seat. So I had to see something happen. I had to realize, oh, I might need this stuff and have the presence of mind to grab it before getting out of the car, all while talking to 911. Well, it's not going to happen. Now I leap out of the car and run in to try to help somebody, and I've got it attached to my ankle.
Mm.
And none of the people that I talked to have said anything about my ankle looking even remotely out of place. It looks normal. Who looks at your feet anyway, right?
Ankle fetishists?
Well, they can check them out. I've got big one. I got a big left one. My pants are a little poofy. But like I said, we'll get a better review of it in about a month once I've worn it for long enough to say, yeah, it holds up or what it doesn't, whatever. We'll see. So far, so good, though.
One ankle's bigger than the other, and we call that one our favorite.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. This intro has just gone on for way too long. I think we should start the show. What do you think, Sean?
Well, maybe we have some people to thank first.
Absolutely right. Special thanks to Lucky Gunner and Remington for their support of the Gunblog Variety Cast. From Golden Saber to Range Rounds, get a full lineup of quality Remington ammo that ships fast at LuckyGunner.com.
All right.
Concealed Carry Magazine's cover girl, Beth, has been busy at a photo shoot all week. Oh, the horror. But she's made a little time for us to talk about how she has to prove herself every day.
I don't want to complain. I really, really don't. But I have noticed some interesting things about the firearms industry. Of course, over the last 10 years especially, women have become a lot more prominent and people are definitely paying attention. And there are so many amazing, trailblazing ladies out there who have truly made a difference for women in concealed carry and, of course, women and the Second Amendment. There are so many ladies out there who are helping make this become a normal, everyday part of women's lives. And that's incredible. But that doesn't mean that there aren't hurdles. And I know that I have some experiences from my own life that kind of show that oftentimes it feels like we're having to prove ourselves over and over again in this industry, especially those of us who don't come from a law enforcement or military background, which of course I don't. As I always say, I'm just a mom with a gun. Unfortunately, sometimes I think that's exactly why I have to keep proving myself no matter where I go or who I'm with. One example that sticks out in my mind was the time that I was interested in purchasing my very own 44 Magnum. I had tried someone's at a shooting range. It was a Taurus. And I thought, wow, this is really a lot of fun. I would love to have one of these guns for myself. In fact, I didn't have my own revolver even at this point. And I guess I may have gone a little bit overboard with my first selection, but that is what I had my heart set on. So I did my research. I got online. I started looking at all the different options. And I finally spotted one that really stuck out to me as one that I wanted to try. And that was the Smith & Wesson Performance Center 629. This 44 Magnum is just absolutely beautiful. It is stunning and it kind of has that steampunk look that I really, really love. And luckily for me, I noticed that one of our local stores had that particular model in stock. So my husband and I went out that very next day. And again, I had my heart set on this gun. I knew that this is what I wanted. I marched straight up to that counter and I said to the gentleman, "I would like to see this revolver, please." Well, he took one look at me, looked at the revolver I was pointing at and said, "Oh, ma'am, I'm not sure that's really the gun that you want. That's a big gun." I said, "Yes, sir, I know. I've been looking at it and I really want to pick it up and hold it and see it." He kind of looked at my husband as if he were trying to get help. And he said, "Well, ma'am, that's a 44 Magnum." I said, "Yes, I know. And I really love it." And it took a while of this kind of going back and forth to even convince him to take it out of the case and let me see it. And of course, I wondered to myself, even at that moment, if my husband had been the one to walk up and say, "I would like to purchase this gun," would he have had the same reaction? Now, granted, I know a 44 Magnum is not really a first purchase and may be an unusual purchase for an average female. And since he didn't know me from Adam, maybe he was just trying to be cautious and make sure that he wasn't selling someone something that they weren't capable of handling. But again, I wonder, would he have had those thoughts had it been my husband walking up to the counter saying, "I want the 629? Another example that stands out in my head actually occurred at a training facility. We had a large class, mostly guys and only two girls, and we had rental guns, and we were all working through our qualifications and our drills and all sorts of different training practices and techniques. And I know that I was really, really struggling. I couldn't hit the target. My shots were just all over the place, and I was getting really, really frustrated. I talked to my instructor about it, and he said, "Well, you know, we'll just keep working on things. Let's definitely focus on that front sight." And of course, he reminded me of all the fundamentals that we all know. But I was just so convinced that something was wrong. Day two of training, I was still going through the same motions and still having the exact same problems. We all know that shooting is basically 80% mental and 20% physical, so at this point now, I'm mentally starting to shut down and have this block. By the end of that day, I was like, okay, I give up. Instructor, please come over here. Could you try this gun and tell me, is it really me or is it the firearm? I need to know because I feel like I'm absolutely going crazy. Well, he came over and he took the firearm from me. He turned it around in his hands and looked at it. And he immediately put it aside and said, you know what? Why don't you use my gun? And I was like, why? What's wrong? He said, nothing. We're going to get you a new one, but go ahead and use my gun. So he handed me his pistol and we went through the qualification again. And this time I did wonderfully. And I was very, very excited to know that, hey, maybe it wasn't me. Maybe it was actually the firearm. It was an equipment problem. It was not me. But again, the thing that pops up in my head is if this had been someone else, maybe one of the guys, would they have waited that long to quote unquote blame it on the gun or check the gun? Or is it just a natural thing because I'm a girl to think, well, you know, she's a woman, she's not going to be as good at shooting, so it must be her. Again, I'm making a lot of assumptions and they could be completely wrong, but it's just something I always have to think about, especially since, like I said, I feel like no matter where I go, no matter who I'm with, I have to prove myself in this industry. Another example actually happened not too long ago while I was at another training class. And for some reason this day, I was having terrible cramps in my hands. And this happens to me off and on, and I don't know what it is. Maybe it's a vitamin deficiency, but my hands will cramp and get into these weird positions that I can't even get them out of. And I'll have to just kind of shake it off and rub it out and, you know, wait a few minutes before I feel comfortable and confident to actually shooting again. Well, this was happening to me during our drills. And my hand cramped up so bad, I couldn't control it. And I'm shaking it out and trying my best to keep going. And the instructor comes over to me and in front of everybody says, well, you know, maybe that 9mm is just too much gun for you. I was absolutely floored. He didn't say it in a joking way. And again, all I could think of was, did he say that to me because I'm a woman? Would he have said that to one of the guys in the class? I was absolutely mortified, completely embarrassed, and it didn't matter how much I tried to explain that no, it was because my hands were cramping. I'm sure in his mind he thought, wow, that little lady shouldn't have brought that big gun to this class because she can't handle it. Again, thankfully, in this industry, we have seen so many wonderful things occurring with women. But I think we also need to realize that it's not fair that we still have this perception or this stigma or this stereotype that females aren't as good as guys or can't shoot as well as guys or maybe can't teach firearms as well as guys. I think it just all depends on the person. I think everyone deserves the same opportunity and chances, and I hope that others out there can both empathize and sympathize with what I'm saying. This is not a complaint. This is not a chance to bash other people, but it is a chance to think. You know, how far have we come and how much farther do we still need to go? Until next time, stay safe and be well armed.
You can read more from Beth at usconcealedcarry.com/blog and click on Pacifiers and Peacemakers in the left sidebar.
This podcast runs on your donations. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the donate or the subscribe button in the right sidebar. You can make a one-time donation of any amount or subscribe for as little as $2 a month. That doesn't sound like much, but we pay our server costs monthly. A little help from you is a big help to us.
Felons behaving badly. Man faces charges of arson, attempted murder, after fire at Fayetteville Hotel. Dateline, Fayetteville, North Carolina. Officials arrested a man on multiple charges Saturday for his connection to a fire and stabbing at a hotel in Fayetteville. Deputies with the Cumberland County Sheriff's Office were headed to an address in Hope Mills to arrest 28-year-old suspect when they saw his car. Deputies initiated a traffic stop, and suspect was arrested without incident. Suspect was connected, officials said, to an incident that occurred February 7th at the Coliseum Inn located at 2507 Gillespie Street.
Stop by and say hi.
According to officials, suspect is accused of setting fire to the door of a room in a hotel in order to draw the victim outside. Reports say suspect hit the victim on the head with a fire extinguisher, striking him several times, and then stabbing him. Suspect was charged with attempted first-degree murder, assault with a deadly weapon inflicting serious injury with the intent to kill, and first-degree arson. He remains in Cumberland County Jail under $400,000 secured bond.
You know, it's awful, but there is a wicked part of me that is just laughing at the irony of the fact that he started a fire and then hit a guy in the head with a fire extinguisher. It's wrong. I'm going to hell for it, but I still find it funny.
Oh, yeah. We have police officers. Why do we need guns? And we have a fire department. Why do we need fire extinguishers? They could have protected this man by not putting out fire extinguishers.
Yes, exactly. If it saves one life. So tell us about our little comedic firebug here, Sean.
Suspect, misdemeanor breaking and entering, misdemeanor class 1. Larceny, misdemeanor class 1. Felony breaking and entering, felon class H. Larceny after breaking and entering, felon class H. And manslaughter, accessory after the fact, felon class F.
Well, it looks like he's gone from accessory to manslaughter to premeditated murder. Way to go.
Luckily, he didn't succeed, but it was probably a pretty close thing if you're beating somebody with a fire extinguisher and then stabbing him.
And the whole fire thing.
Yeah. Baron is on assignment and will return soon.
Hey, this is Lloyd Bailey, the Armed Lutheran, host of the Armed Lutheran Radio Podcast, reminding you that the podcast you're listening to is a proud member of the Self-Defense Radio Network. Check out all the great content at selfdefenseradio.net.
The main topic.
I thought it would be interesting to talk about the feeling that new concealed carriers have that everyone can see their gun and everyone is looking at them going, gun, 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 you have a gun. And how those of us who have moved past that, you know, what our tips and techniques are just for getting through it and what we can pass on to new carriers.
I vividly remember the time where I was convinced that everyone could see that I was carrying a gun. It was awful. I need to be extra careful. I need to dress very carefully. I need to keep making sure that I'm properly covered. It was terrible. Now, as I understand it, psychologists have sort of like an effect, a name, something that they call this everybody's looking at you effect.
Yeah, it was called the spotlight effect in 1999, although the effect has been around for much longer. And yeah. The idea, much like the name suggests, is that you feel like there is a spotlight on you and everyone can see you.
Now, I think it's really interesting how Wikipedia puts it. The reasoning behind the spotlight effect comes from innate tendency to forget that although one is the center of one's own world, one is not the center of everyone else's. This should be like tattooed on the inside of everybody's eyelids at 16. You are the center of your own world, but you're sure not the center of everybody else's.
Yeah, but you can understand the logic behind it. I mean, you are you, so clearly you are aware of what you are doing. And there's that feeling that, well, if I'm aware, everyone else has to be aware of it too. Oh my God.
Exactly. But they're not. That's the funny thing, is nobody really is paying attention to you. What I ended up doing, what got me over it, was I started open carrying with the group in Pennsylvania. Now, I wasn't out wandering the street with a tap code out SKS. I went to open carry picnics or open carry dinners. We went to a park and we all open carried and had picnic lunch or stuff like that. And it was also in Pennsylvania, it tended to be used as a sort of a political thing where if we had a park where the town had a sign up that says you couldn't have a gun, which was completely contradictory to the Pennsylvania state law, well, what we could do is we could just go have an open carry picnic in that park because they couldn't arrest us for violating a city ordinance that was precluded or preempted by the state law. There's just nothing they could do about it. And it was a way to show them, you have no power, this sign is invalid. And usually all we had to do was sort of threaten that and they'd take the sign down. But what I found out about open carrying is not that no one notices. I've come to understand that it's not that no one notices. It's that most people just don't care. There's so many people out there that you're going to run into who are going to say, oh, well, I carry this. Or, oh, I have this gun at home. Gun people are like that. We all talk to each other. Even those who are not really deep, deep gun people like, you know, the far right-hand side of the bell curve, the people who do podcasts on this stuff, or the people even that listen to podcasts about this stuff. I mean, just your average Joe has a gun at home. And if he runs into somebody who is interested in guns, has a tendency to want to talk about it. It's just kind of how we are. And once I realized that I could open carry legally, and I'm concealed legally. What was I worried about?
I came about it in an entirely ass-backwards way, which is perfectly in keeping with how Aaron does things. And so I have to tell a little story. And this all begins with me being a goth, if you can believe this, circa 99 to 2003 in Washington, D.C. I make no apologies for this. I enjoy going to goth clubs. I love the music. I love the atmosphere. It's just a thing that I do. I haven't done it for a while because there isn't one near where I live, but I'm still consider myself goth positive. and I was still in my 20s at the time. So it's like, all right, you know, I've got to get ready. So I've got to put on the black clothing and, you know, I'll put on the makeup and I didn't actually have any piercings, but I had found the use of spirit gum. And so I could put little things on that made it look like piercing. And, you know, the whole Sharpie tattoo things. Just, I don't know. It felt like a thing to do. I was young. I had a good time doing it. But then once I got all dressed up, you see, I had to actually get to the club. And because I didn't feel like driving because I was going to the club to imbibe an alcohol, I would get on the DC Metro. I don't know if people know this, but if you're on public transportation and you're all gothed up and you look kind of like you may have stepped out of a Marilyn Manson video, people are gonna look. They're gonna stare at you really, really hard. Maybe because they wonder you're gonna snap and kill them all, or maybe it's just, wow, I've never seen anything like that. Or maybe it's just, wow, you look like a freak. I don't know how to handle this. Because, you see, I had stepped outside of the standard of social mores. I mean, I wasn't completely unacceptable, but I was on that fringe. At first, I was really self-conscious. You know, I had to tell myself, look, I'm not doing anything wrong. It's perfectly okay for me to be dressed like this. It's perfectly okay for me to be using the metro. I'm not hurting anyone's feelings. I mean, I may be offending their sensibilities, but I'm not actually inconveniencing anyone. What I am doing is acceptable. And of course, that was made easier if I hung out with some of my other friends going to or coming back from the club. I had gotten all of that angst out of my system earlier. So that when the time came for me to start carrying my concealed pistol, I had already gotten that whole don't really care what people think. When I started carrying, I noticed, because I wasn't worried about what everyone else was thinking, I noticed that for the most part, people didn't notice. People are mostly clueless. I mean, if you're a concealed carrier, you know what to look for. I mean, when I was at Mag 40 with my friend Eric Dubb, we were at the hotel breakfast bar playing the game of, okay, who else here is in Mag 40? Okay, you've got a Rangemaster shirt you're carrying. Oh, you've got a cover garment you're definitely carrying. That sort of thing. But most people just don't notice because most people, for whatever reason, that just isn't part of their life. And so they don't look.
Luke from Triangle Tactical says that there's a sort of concealed carry uniform. He says he's never, ever spotted a concealed carrier in the wild, but he has looked and said, that guy, he's carrying, and then looked and found the gun.
Yeah.
There's like a uniform. Adam, our previous co-host, Adam knew that I was going to the Lucky Gunner machine gun shoot because he saw me at the hotel and I was wearing cargo pocket pants. He thought they were 511s. I explained they were actually cheap Wrangler cargo pants that I got from Walmart, but that's how he decided that I was one of the people who was going to go to the Lucky Gunner shoot. That's how we get spotted. We know each other's clothing. Not that people see the gun. If you've got a bulge underneath your shirt, well, you're probably carrying a cell phone there nowadays. And Luke also, another thing that Luke from Triangle Tactical says, is he's worked security for a large retailer. This whole thing that you open carry, nobody notices, that's not true. Every time somebody comes in the store who's carrying a gun, and it happened all the time, he'd get a call. Oh, there's somebody, he's carrying a gun. Okay, what's he doing? Well, it's in a holster. Okay, so leave him alone. Let me know or let the police know if he pulls it out and does something. But other than that, leave him alone. So this whole notion that nobody notices, no, everybody's just too polite to say anything. And you know what? You're not breaking the law. so don't sweat it. If you're carrying legally, even if somebody figures it out, and even if they call the police, and even if the police show up, you're just going to show him your concealed handgun permit, and he's going to go, oh, have a nice day. There's actually kind of a funny story. It's how you and I sort of met, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I was playing a Dungeons & Dragons game in real life, not over the internet like I was playing with you guys in the last couple of weeks. We had somebody come to the door, knock on the door, and tell the host, hey, I need to use your phone. My phone's, you know, I can't find my phone. I need to call my friend. And, you know, alarm bells going off in my head. My wife's like, scam, scam, don't. And the idiot lets her in, right? Lets her into the house and hands her his cell phone. All of us were just like, no, you idiot. So I take my dog and put her in front of me, and I put myself between the door and everybody else. I'm not worried about this girl. I could knock this girl out with one punch. And, you know, I've never been a boxer. I'm not a big guy. But this girl was a waif. I could have punched her and knocked her senseless. I'm worried about her holding the door open for the three-man home invasion crew who's going to follow in behind her. So I'm standing there with a 70-pound dog and a 45 caliber pistol waiting for something to go sideways. I'm watching her really carefully looking for, you know, some tell that she hears them coming or she's standing out of the way or anything like that. I got another guy. He's like, we need pictures. So he turns on the video camera on his iPhone and walks past her on the way to the bathroom, right? And videotapes her. Everybody else is just sort of on high alert. And finally, she leaves, but she hands him the phone. She really quickly runs and jumps into this car and takes off. We're like, call 911 right now. Because one of two things, she was looking for an easy target for a home invasion, which seems kind of unlikely in Cary, North Carolina. But, you know, you never know what's going to happen to you. Or she's casing the joint looking for stuff to steal. Is this a house that's worth trying to break into and steal stuff during the day tomorrow? So we call the cops. It was like a Thanksgiving weekend or something like that. It was kind of one of those, it should have been a holiday, everybody doing stuff, but it tried to snow. So I guess the Cary police had every single officer on duty for this snowfall that never actually happened. So we had a response in like 5 minutes. I'm thinking North Carolina requires you to tell the police upon being approached by them that you're carrying concealed. And I don't know if that applies inside a house or not, but I figured it better safe than sorry. I pull out my wallet. As the host is telling the police officer what happened, I walked up to him and I said, look, I don't know if this applies inside a private residence, but here. And I hand him my concealed handgun permit. He takes it from me. He looks at it. He looks at me. Kind of gives me a little smile and a nod, and he hands it back to me, and I put it in my pocket. The DM, he's like, what the hell was that? What did you just hand him? Is that like your CIA card or something? Is that like your get out of jail free card? And I'm like, shut up, dude. He's like, no, man, what was going on? I'm like, shut the hell up. I'll
be
explain
cool, man.
Later.
Be cool.
What he didn't realize was that A, I was carrying, B, three other people in that game had gone to the concealed handgun permit class with me. So they all knew what I had just done. None of them had, you know, gotten around to actually getting their own gun and carrying it yet. But they're all looking at me like, psh, I knew what he just did. The Dungeon Master, he just kept bugging me. I'm like, look, dude, what I showed him was my permit to carry a handgun. He's like, no, you're not carrying a handgun. You must be carrying some little tiny gun. I'm like, come here. And I take him out on the porch, on the back porch, so that nobody has to see this. And I hike up my sweatshirt, and I'm carrying a 4-inch barrel, 45 caliber XD. And he's like, oh my God, how did I never know that you just carried that today? You've never carried it before. I mean, no, I've carried it for every single game we've been playing. You just haven't noticed. So if I can sit in a group with the same people for weeks at a time, like this game had been going on for probably 9 months at that point, and the guy who's running the show doesn't even notice, then pretty much nobody else is going to notice when you're concealed carrying. So just relax about it.
And what's funny, at least I think it's funny, is that for me, carrying concealed actually helped me be a better transgender. And I'll keep this brief because I know this makes some people uncomfortable, but what it comes down to is this. I noticed that people just don't notice unless something is like right there actively in their face. So if you are just moving along like everything is cool, there's nothing to worry about, they'll just gloss over you. My experience with carrying concealed where people just didn't notice, it taught me that, yeah, if you just make an effort to get along and not stand out, either they won't notice, or like you said that Luke said, they notice, but they don't comment. And honestly, either one is fine, because really what I think gun owners are worried about is either unwelcome police attention or people making them feel awkward or unwelcome. You know, how dare you carry that gun around me? Once you realize that people are so wrapped up in their own little worlds that they aren't going to notice, you go, hey, it's cool. I can carry what I want. I can dress how I want. Most people aren't going to notice. And that is just so tremendously liberating.
And in the end, you're carrying legally. You have a permit or a license, or you're in a constitutional carry state. You're not doing anything wrong. So even if they call the cops are going to say, have a nice day. So don't sweat it.
Tiffany is on assignment and will return next week.
And now it's time for Blue Collar Prepping with that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Erin Paulette.
Come on, every pony. It's time for Blue Collar Prepping with Erin Paulette.
Newspapers just aren't taken as seriously as they once were. Between lack of readers, cost of production, and the 24/7 news cycle, which is better suited to online reporting, actual newsprint is going the way of the dodo. But that doesn't mean that newspapers aren't of use to preppers. Quite the opposite. The prepping value of a newspaper, though, is in its material and not what the rag says. There's an old joke from the middle of last century which says that certain papers are only good for lining bird cages, wrapping fish, and toilet training dogs. And these are all good uses for the material. Newspaper is made from wood pulp, which is very absorbent. So depending on the cleanliness of the paper, you can use it as an impromptu towel for drying off or for wiping up spills, or even as field expedient toilet paper. But one of the best uses for old newspaper is for drying out wet shoes. Stuff them with crumpled up newspaper and leave them overnight. And in the morning, the moisture will have moved from your shoes to the paper. And this is a great trick to know if you've gotten wet and can't start a fire. Speaking of starting a fire, it ought to be obvious to everyone that newspapers make great fire starters. Finely shredded bits of newspaper can serve as tinder, thin strips can serve as kindling, and rolled up papers can even serve as fuel if you have enough of them. Just be aware that newspaper doesn't have much in the way of energy density. It burns quickly, unlike a log. But newspaper can keep you warm in other ways. If you crumple it up and stick it under your clothes, it can act as insulation by trapping warm air next to your body. If you're settling down for the night, you can further protect yourself against the elements by putting a layer underneath you to insulate you against the cold ground and absorb any moisture, and then another layer on top of you like a blanket to trap more heat and protect you from the wind, rain, and snow. Side note, if you're out in the woods, you can achieve the same effect with dry leaves. Now, you can also use newspaper to keep your home warm by wadding it into nooks and crannies and creating insulation that way, or taping it over windows to prevent drafts. And finally, you can use newspaper to create a weapon. I know this sounds crazy, but apparently soccer hooligans in the UK were bringing newspapers to games and using them to create improvised clubs called Millwall Bricks. Watch the video in the show notes. And you'll see that with some rolled and folded newspaper, a rock, and some paper, you can transform trash into a tomahawk that is capable of splitting a gallon milk container and denting a 55-gallon drum. There are many things you can do with newspaper once you realize that it is, essentially, a very thin sheet of wood. While newspapers themselves may soon become obsolete, for as long as newsprint exists, there will be uses for the material.
Not only can you subscribe or donate to the podcast, you can also make a contribution to the LGBT Training Ammo Fund. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the LGBT Training Ammo Fund donation button in the right sidebar. I'll use this money to pay for range fees, targets, and yes, ammo for the people I teach. And thanks for your support. This week, Weird dissects a talk given by Devin Hughes of Armed With Reason on behalf of Moms Demand Illegal Mayors for Everytown, a wholly owned subsidiary of Michael Bloomberg Incorporated. In This week in anti-gun nuttery.
So you all may remember Devin Hughes. He with Evan DeFilippis make up the anti-gun duo known as Armed With Reason. They also work for Michael Bloomberg in as many of his AstroTurf venues as they can. This audio is from a talk given by Devin in Tulsa, Oklahoma, on behalf of Bloomberg's Moms Demand Action. Devin starts out with an overview of gun laws in the United States and how his home of Oklahoma compares with the nation.
Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, I think they merged with another group just recently. They give us a well-deserved F when it comes to gun laws. We're about 25th on the gun law rank, which sounds high, but about half the states have a failing grade.
So this is a key to anti-gun nuttery. The bulk of the United States is ranked as F or D by this puppet of Mark Kelly, the manipulative husband of disabled former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. Further, only California gains the rank of A, with all the usual suspect states of gun control getting an A-minus grade. It reads like an A-plus is possible as they dock California for allowing guns in bars and state parks and not mandating personalized handguns, which I assume is the so-called smart guns. This clearly illustrates that there is no middle ground between anti-gunners and gun owners. If California, New York, New Jersey, and Massachusetts are too lax, there really isn't any room for appeasement. Note one thing in common to all anti-gun activists and politicians is that there is no law or proposal that is too absurd or goes too far with them. This is because all gun ownership is objectionable to them. They just know that their numbers and influence are so small that they could never propose their grand goal in mixed company. Next, he moves on to bills that are currently up for debate that he's against. First, one that would allow Oklahoma to issue non-resident permits.
Allow non-residents to obtain handgun license and online applications. Now, that's not necessarily bad for us, but it is bad for people in other states where they might have tougher licensing requirements. They recognize Oklahoma licenses, then they'll be able to get their license here and then just go about their business in whatever state that is.
By tougher licensing, he really means states that will not issue permits to law-abiding citizens unless they make it well worth their while in the form of political favors or outright bribes. Oklahoma is a shall-issue state that requires a basic training course. So really, more strict when it comes to them are places like New Jersey, Maryland, or Massachusetts, where the state just often refuses to issue a permit.
Utah had quite a similar thing going on for a number of years. I think they still have that, where you can just get it online, no need to actually fire a gun or anything, and the quiz would be very easy. And they let so many people from other states would just get that license because it was so much easier.
Well, Devin certainly did his research. To get a Utah concealed firearms permit, you must take a class, in person, not online, with a certified Utah instructor. These instructors can operate in any state for the convenience of people looking to get one of their fine non-resident permits. And where have you read problems with Utah carry permit holders? The only places I've read about it are anti-gun states that blanket refuse to recognize the right to bear arms, getting butthurt that their disarmed citizens can carry outside the state in free America.
So if a city has stricter gun laws than the state, they're not allowed to do that, and I believe this bill puts fines on those cities. So not only are you not allowed to do it, if you do it, it'll cost you like $10,000 a month or something for however long you have that bill on the books.
He's talking about a bill that puts teeth on Oklahoma's state preemption gun laws. This is a fantastic policy, because once you allow every little town or neighborhood to pass their own pet ordinance, it becomes impossible for people who travel about the state to comply with the law. And this bill means that if some town wants to ignore this law, the state has a great way to enforce it. The whole point of local firearms law is to either get people who can legally carry to simply refuse to do it, or to charge people acting in a reasonable manner and consistent with state law with a crime because they crossed some unmarked boundary.
If you would typically carry a gun but can't carry it into a business and then injured in such a way where a gun may have helped you somehow, you can then sue that business because they didn't let you carry a gun in there.
Again, another great law. First up, the bulk of businesses that ban employees from carrying firearms on premises aren't anti-gun nutty places. They've just been informed by their legal counsel that if an employee attempts to defend themselves or another employee and is injured or injures another person, they could be held responsible for the injury. This law is simply looking at the other side of it. If you remove a person's tools for self-defense, then you're essentially making their safety your responsibility. Given that most businesses who enact an anti-gun policy do nothing to protect employees from injury, this law makes a great compromise between property rights and the right to keep and bear arms. Now a great comment from the audience.
Are these organic? Are they coming out of the people or the legislators in Oklahoma, or is it the NRA pushing it?
First, let's savor the irony that this whole talk is being put on by one of Michael Bloomberg's many shell groups. Yes, Shannon Watts is the president of Moms Demand Action, but that's owned by Bloomberg, making him a monolith. But let's hear Devin's answer.
But most of these are, some versions of these are occurring across the country. So Oklahoma is not alone in facing this barrage of bad bills.
So because the Oklahoma's pro-gun bills are similar to other pro-gun bills around the country, that denotes central planning? No. That shows grassroots efforts that are looking at how other pro-gun groups are operating in other states. Compare this with the anti-gun side. Remember Michael Bloomberg's ballot initiative for universal background checks that won by the narrowest of margins in Nevada? Since Bloomberg is forcing his agenda by any means necessary, the Nevada ballot question was simply copypasta from his previous initiatives in Colorado, Oregon, and Washington, as well as there was an identical copy on the ballot in Maine that was defeated. Except Nevada is one of those states that elected to conduct their background checks in-state rather than using the federal NICS database directly. Since the Bloomberg law stated that the state transfers had to be done through the FBI NICS database, and the Nevada state law says FFLs may only conduct background checks through Nevada Department of Public Safety, the state attorney general deemed that these two laws were so incompatible that the Bloomberg initiative has been thrown out. One would assume that if the anti-gun movement in America was organic or grassroots, the Nevada ballot question would have been written by Nevada residents who understand how their state laws work, rather than a New York billionaire pushing his failed federal agenda on individual states piecemeal.
The one thing the NRA does really well, other than lobbying, is creating graphics.
Okay, this is just another example of weapons-grade irony. Go to the show notes and watch the full presentation. Devin Hughes' slideshow is about 70% graphics from Bloomberg's The Traced. Amazing.
Violent crime rate going down, number of new guns going up. Now, part of the problem here with this graphic is that they're measuring the number of new guns. But people can own more than one gun.
Yep, the gun sales are up, but gun ownership is down fallacy. Well, first, U.S. gun makers are making record numbers of guns that are selling. For gun ownership to be down, wouldn't that mean that large numbers of gun owners are selling off their collections so they can become former gun owners? For his numbers to work, the market would need to be absolutely flooded with used guns. Except in the post-Sandy Hook panic buy, shelves were bare, and many of the gun makers were adding extra shifts to meet demands. Further, permits are up, including places like Massachusetts and Illinois, where you need a permit to own a gun in the first place. And the numbers of young people, women, and minorities that are now owning guns and getting carry permits doesn't support that theory. Nor does the fact that gun ownership is becoming more prevalent in urban and suburban areas, compared to just a few decades ago when the bulk of gun ownership was isolated to the countryside. Like much of his presentation, this is an utter lie. Next, this paragon of virtue attempts to debunk the idea that Americans defend themselves with firearms.
Also, it's the people, you know, because one of the typical gun advocate fantasy is basically you're out walking and a stranger attacks you, and you only have a couple seconds to act. Well, the overwhelming majority of these times, it's a non-stranger, so it's somebody you know, or probably less likely to suspect.
He's right. You're more likely to shoot your estranged ex who you took out a restraining order against than a total stranger, or the local drug dealer who doesn't like a square living on his block. Or the neighborhood loser who's in and out of jail who decides to break into your house at 2 a.m. Also, the studies he's citing, like many anti-gun studies, don't control for lawful citizens using gun in self-defense and criminal street violence. So a gangland assassination where the shooter hunted down and murdered his rival is also considered shooting of a known person. What's his point? If he had one, he didn't bother to explain it. Next, he dives into one of Bloomberg's pet agendas, trying to minimize Chicago's violent crime problem.
Chicago has seen a spike in the recent year, in 2016. It's in eighth place. But St. Louis is way out here. 59.3 versus 27.9 per 100,000. And these are murders. Baltimore, Detroit, New Orleans. So there's all these cities that have around the same homicide problem there.
See? Chicago isn't that bad. Except it is. Also note that he mentions Baltimore's murder rate is higher than Chicago's. Further, for reasons unknown, his little list doesn't include Oakland, California, or Rockford, Illinois, who all have higher violent crime rates than Chicago. Of course, there are plenty of cities on the list with very reasonable gun laws. This fact doesn't prove that gun laws work, or that more guns means less crime. Instead, it clearly shows that violent crime rates involve factors that are not gun laws.
So gun laws do have a significant impact.
What does the NRA say to that?
Oh, they don't get this far.
They
usually stop at Chicago.
Except Devin only mentioned Baltimore that one time and ignored it for the rest of the presentation and never mentioned places like Oakland or Rockford. Further, Devin ignores the bulk of the United States where guns are not heavily restricted and violent crime is at the statistical noise level. Last, we dive into gun-free zones.
The other one, gun-free zones are to blame. So criminals don't, they just look at the sign on the building and go, aha, I shall strike here because nobody has a gun. Well, if they do that, they're really bad at it because 16 of 33 mass public shootings from 2009 to 2015 occurred in an area where guns were allowed by law.
Wrong, wrong, wrong. If you go back to episode 106, I looked at a much more extensive list of FBI classified mass shootings and found that over 57% of those attacks were in gun-free zones, and 84% of all mass shootings had some sort of anti-gun policy on the venue.
And even San Bernardino, which is also pointed as a case where the shooter was strategically choosing his location, he only mentions police officers. Not once does he mention civilians carrying firearms.
Because San Bernardino is one of those places where the county refuses to issue permits to law-abiding citizens. He also attempted to make the same argument with the shooter in the Aurora Theater in Colorado. Except the killer wrote in his journal about how theatergoers would be likely totally unsuspecting of a spree attack, and his only concern was the police response time. Also, not to sound paranoid, but his entire journal only had 3 pages that were redacted. And these were whole pages, not just names and addresses. And these 3 pages were right in the middle of his detailed plan on how he selected that theater. An entire presentation of twisted truth and blatant lies, again showing that anti-gunners never argue in good faith.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host on The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com.
Plug of the week, the Glock gadget?
Yeah. So the Glock gadget is nominally known as the Striker Control Device, made by the Tau Development Group. It's a hinged construct of metal that replaces the plastic slide cover plate on the back of most Glocks. It won't fit the Glock 42 and 43. It's used to help you safely holster your firearm. The way it works is that when you pull the trigger on a Glock, the striker moves backwards, which causes this hinged back plate to move. And so by applying pressure on the plate with your thumb, you can prevent an accidental discharge, such as when you're holstering your pistol and something gets caught inside the trigger guard. And so as you're holstering, if something gets caught, you feel the pressure of the plate against your thumb as it resists the striker going backward. And that not only alerts you to the problem that, hey, there's something that's depressing the trigger, you might want to do something about that, but it also prevents the firearm from discharging because you're applying pressure, you're preventing it from going all the way back. One of the things that I think is very neat about the gadget is that, like Baron says, it fails unsafe. That is, if it ever breaks or malfunctions, it doesn't interfere with the operation of your Glock. Now, I bought mine several years ago via the Indiegogo crowdfund campaign for it, and it took a while to be realized. I only got mine this year, but I received it in time for Mag 40, And I'm pleased to announce that not only did it function perfectly over all the drills and the 500 plus rounds of ammunition I shot that weekend, but it also integrated perfectly with how the instructors taught us to holster our pistols. They told us specifically to put our thumb on the back of the slide when holstering. Now, admittedly, that was for guns with external hammers, but hey, that's precisely how the Glock gadget is meant to be used, and so I used it perfectly that entire weekend. In fact, bit of a fun story here, at one point during the class, one of the range safety officers came up to me and said, "Hey Aaron, the back plate on your Glock looks broken, it's flopping back and forth." And I just grinned at him and said, "No, that's a safety mod. Let me show you how it works when the range goes cold." And so it did, and I did, and he seemed really impressed with it. Now, the Glock gadget, aka the Striker Control device, is available for $79 plus shipping. I think shipping is $5, I'm not certain. I really like it. I know it's expensive, but it's less expensive than a hole in your thigh. So I recommend it to anyone who carries a Glock daily. It's easy to install, it's easy to use, and hey, it survived a Mag 40 course, so you know it's durable.
Well, that's our show for the week. Remember that the Gunblog Varietycast is a member of the Self-Defense Radio Network.
Find the show notes at gunblogvarietycast.com/episode135.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Gunblog Varietycast. Music courtesy of Rob Allen at blog.roballen.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play Music. This podcast is made possible by the Firearms Policy Coalition and by contributions from listeners like you.
And it's probably the most popular category there. Oh, clearly it's the most... It's probably... Well, it's clearly, as far as I can tell... Yeah. It's clearly the most... Deputies with the Cumberland County Sheriff's Office were headed to an address in Hope Mills to arrest... Were headed to an address in Hope Mills to address... Deputies with the Cumberland County Sheriff's Office were headed to an address in Hope Mills... Aaron, this one was actually your idea, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Or was that your cue for me to introduce it?
Why don't you go ahead and introduce it?
Okay. Yes, it was. I thought it would be interesting to talk about that feeling new carriers... I thought it would be useful to talk about the feeling that new concealed carriers have... My turn?
If you like, sure. Okay. I just kind of stopped there, so...
Yeah.
Further, only California gains the rank of A with... Oh, Jesus. I was trying to hold that back to the next cut. With all the usual suspect states of gun control getting the A-minus grade.
Try again.
With all the usual suspect states of gun control getting an A-minus grade. As well as there was an identical copy of the ballot in Maine that was defeated.
On the ballot. As well as the identical copy on the ballot.
Yeah. Okay. I'll try again. Where do I start?
As well as?
As well as there was an identical copy of the ballot in Maine.
You said of again. Defeated.
As well as there was an identical copy on the ballot in Maine that was defeated. Next, this bastion of virtue attempts to debunk the idea that Americans defend themselves with firearms.
Bastion is a physical location. I think you want to say something that applies to a person.
This paragon of virtue. So you all may remember Devin Hughes. He with Evan DeFilippis, they just know that their numbers and influence are so small Further, Further, for reasons unknown, his little list doesn't include Oakland, California, and Rockford, Illinois, who also... Illinois. Jesus Christ. I just graduated the third grade. I could poop in the big boy potty. Further, for reasons unknown, his little list doesn't include Oakland, California, or Rockford... Fuck. Further, for reasons unknown, his little list doesn't include Oakland, California, or Rockford, Illinois. Because San Bernardino is one of those places where the...
This is a URS production.